Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman. French police avert another attack. Police in Paris shot and killed a knife-wielding man wearing a fake explosives vest outside of a police station in the northern part of Paris Thursday, a year to the day since an attack on the French satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo launched a bloody year in the French capital. France has been under a state of emergency since a series of attacks claimed by the Islamic State group killed 130 people in Paris on November 13th. And tensions increased this week as the anniversary of the January attacks approached. Soldiers were posted in front of schools and security forces were even more present than usual amid a series of tributes to the dead. Officials said the man was shot to death Thursday, was wearing a fake explosive vest, and threatened officers at the entrance of a police station minutes after French President François Hollande, speaking at a different location, paid respects to officers fallen in the line of duty. A spokesman for the Interior Ministry said the man at the police station is believed to have cried out Allahu Akbar, Arabic for God is great. He has not been identified. A massive truck bomb exploded near a police station in the western Libyan town of Zlitten Thursday, killing at least 60 policemen and wounding around 200 others. No group immediately claimed responsibility for the attack, but a local Islamic State affiliate has been trying to gain a foothold in Zlitten, spreading westward from its central stronghold of Sirte along the northern African country's coast. Hours after the blast, rescue crews at the scene had only managed to extract 60 bodies out of the wreckage, according to a hospital spokesman. Officials said they believe there might be dozens more dead. This is VOA News. The United States and its two key Asian allies, Japan and South Korea, are pledging what a South Korean official calls the most powerful and comprehensive sanctions against North Korea following its fourth nuclear test Wednesday. President Obama discussed the matter by phone early Thursday with South Korea's President Park Geun-hye and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. South Korea has also announced a resumption of cross-border propaganda broadcasts the North had previously called an act of war. Stephen Norper of the New York-based Korea Society says one nation above all faces a perceived threat from the North Korean test.
China is the largest loser in this particular case. Chinese citizens are very frightened of nuclear fallout from North Korea. You will see, I'm sure, an amassing of PLA forces toward the border in coming days. And the Chinese have very vociferously, through their foreign ministry, condemned this test. And the Xi Jinping administration appears, frankly, to really be at a very strong breaking point with North Korea over this. We'll have to see how far that goes.
Norper says concerns over the North's nuclear direction over the next 10 to 20 years, if left unchecked, could give some new impetus to restarting suspended six-party talks on denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula. Witnesses in the Yemeni capital of Sana'a are discounting Iranian claims that Saudi Arabia hit Tehran's embassy there in an overnight strike. Iran accused Saudi Arabia of deliberately hitting the diplomatic outpost. However, witnesses in Sana'a said there was no visible damage to the building, just some stones and shrapnel that apparently landed in the embassy's yard after a Saudi airstrike hit a public square about 700 meters from the embassy. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Hussein Jaber Ansari said the alleged air attacks on Sana'a were a violation of all international conventions that protect diplomatic missions, that according to state television. Also Thursday, Iran's cabinet banned the import of all products from Saudi Arabia, that according to a government statement. Iran imports about $60 million worth of products from Saudi Arabia every year, mostly packing materials and textiles. Tehran said nothing about its $130 million annual export business with the Saudis, mostly steel, cement, and agricultural products. Tehran also adopted a ban on Iranians traveling to the holy city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia. Well, Americans are now being told they can eat eggs guilt-free. That's but one of new nutritional recommendations issued by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehishu Heeb, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Arusha, Tanzania was supposed to be the location for peace talks between Burundi's government and opposition groups Wednesday, after discussions opened last month in Uganda. But the talks were canceled, with no future ones on the horizon, adding to the problems for a country that has been experiencing unrest since April of last year.
That's VOA East Africa correspondent Jill Craig reporting. Details coming up.
Also in the news, more than 65 people died today as a truck exploded at a police training camp in the Libyan port city of Zlitin. And researchers say an experimental transfusion of blood plasma from Ebola survivors has been proven ineffective.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, peace talks between Burundi's government and opposition groups were postponed yesterday without being rescheduled. VOA's Jill Craig reports from Nairobi that a senior foreign affairs minister said the government will not speak with those it says are supporting violence.
Arusha, Tanzania was supposed to be the location for peace talks between Burundi's government and opposition groups Wednesday, after discussions opened last month in Uganda. But the talks were canceled, with no future ones on the horizon, adding to the problems for a country that has been experiencing unrest since April of last year. The Human Rights Watch senior researcher on Burundi and Rwanda is Karina Tertsakian.
It's certainly regrettable that the different parties don't seem to be able to come together. And I would say particularly on the government side, the government does not seem to be acknowledging the urgency of a need to take measures to stop the violence.
Tertsakian notes there has been violence committed by both the government and opposition, but the government needs to admit its role.
In particular, it is not accepting responsibility for the conduct of its own security forces, who have killed many people in Burundi since the crisis began. Instead, it is wholesale blaming the opposition groups for all the killings that are going on in Burundi, even though much evidence points to the contrary.
Last month, the African Union announced it would send 5,000 peacekeepers into Burundi to stop the violence. President Pierre Nkurunziza responded that everyone has to respect Burundi borders. Otherwise, he said, the country would consider itself under attack and would fight back. Many people hoped the president's remarks would be further discussed at the Arusha talks, but International Crisis Group Central Africa Project Director Thierry Vercoulon says it was likely just a threat.
What I think is that actually the African Union has threatened Burundi to deploy a peacekeeping force that it doesn't have, and therefore the threat is not credible. I mean, there are two problems. The first problem is the political approval by the member states. And the second problem is that this peacekeeping force does not exist.
Regardless of what the international community does to try to resolve the crisis, Vercoulon says he does not believe government officials have much incentive to negotiate.
Despite the fact that the regime is already under stress, and especially financial stress, they haven't moved. They haven't made any concession, any kind of thing. And because they're radicals, and they're ready to go to the end, unless they are put under tremendous pressure, they're not going to change.
The talks were intended to help stem the violence in Burundi, where at least 400 people have been killed since Nkurunziza announced he was running for a controversial third term in April. He won re-election in July in a poll boycotted by the opposition. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
More than 65 people died today as a truck exploded at a police training camp in the Libyan port city of Zlatan. The explosion occurred as new police recruits were assembling at the camp, which is on the western coast of the country. Hospital officials say another 200 were wounded. Local officials expect the death toll to climb. UN envoy to Libya, Martin Kobler, says the explosion was a suicide attack. No one claimed responsibility for the bombing, but a local Islamic State affiliate has been trying to gain a foothold in Zlatan from its central stronghold of Sirte. Kobler condemned the suicide attack and called on all Libyans to urgently unite in fighting against against terrorism. The UN has sought a power-sharing agreement between two competing parliaments and several Libyan militias. Libya is split between an Islamist administration that seized Tripoli and the internationally recognized parliament that fled east to Tobruk. Members of Libya's rival governments last month signed a peace deal despite concerns about the legitimacy of the much-disputed pact. The country has been in chaos and political uncertainty since dictator Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown and killed in 2011.
Researchers say an experimental transfusion of blood plasma from Ebola survivors has been proven ineffective. Dr. Johan van Grensven of the Antwerp Institute of Tropical Medicine writes in the new issue of the New England Journal of Medicine that trials carried out last year in Guinea on 84 patients show the plasma injections proved no more effective than other treatments. The plasma treatment was once the top experimental therapy recommended by the WHO for testing during the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. That outbreak killed more than 11,000 people. Van Grensven says there is still a possibility that the treatment could be effective in certain circumstances. An unusually high proportion of young children and pregnant women who received it during the study survived. However, because only a small number of them were part of the study, conclusions could not be drawn.
At least one person was killed and several dozen wounded today as hundreds of armed Cameroonian youths attacked police stations in the capital, Yaoundé. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé. The youths were protesting what they say are excesses and human rights abuses by the police.
This is the sound of hundreds of youths attacking police stations in Mokolu, one of Yaoundé's largest markets. Some are carrying locally made guns, machetes, and stones. Businesswoman Zekem Maria, who is among the protesters, say they are against police brutality and extortion.
The police come here, they harass people, they beat people, and people are very angry with them because they make ladder and kill one of the people. The other day they came here, they killed one young man.
The most senior police officer in the area, Foswa Martin Claude, says the youths were avenging the death of a suspect who was wounded in a shootout with the police. He says the suspect had seized money from a lady in the market and resisted police attempts to arrest him. Claude says police fear the attacks may extend to other markets in the capital city. He says it is intolerable to defy public security and they are going to arrest all criminals. He says he has asked for more policemen to be deployed to the market. The attacks continued spreading from the police station to police posts in the area. Although most of the attackers were eventually pushed back, there are still pockets of resistance in the market. A senior government official in the area, Yampem Usman, says he hopes business can quickly get back to normal. He says thanks to the energetic action taken by the police, peace is returning to the area and business activity has to resume. Cameroonians have often accused their police of corrupt practices. Last month, Transparency International reported Cameroon was one of the most corrupt countries in sub-Saharan Africa and said its police are among the most corrupt professional groups. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 15 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. More than 65 people died today as a truck exploded at the police training camp in the Libyan port city of Zlatan. And researchers say an experimental transfusion of blood plasma from Ebola survivors has been proven ineffective. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The new UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, urges governments not to succumb to the growing dangers of xenophobia, but to offer protection to people fleeing war and persecution, as set down in the 1951 Refugee Convention. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, where the new refugee chief assumes his post at a time of unprecedented global displacement.
Filippo Grandi, a 58-year-old Italian national, is no newcomer to the agency he now leads. He worked for the UNHCR for many years before leaving 12 years ago to assume other positions in refugee organizations. His last job was as head of the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. Grandi, who replaces Antonio Guterres as High Commissioner, says the number of refugees and displaced people around the world has almost tripled to around 60 million over the past 12 years. During this period, he says, Afghanistan has gone from being a country of repatriation to one that once again is producing refugees. Grandi began working in Sudan in the late 1980s in the midst of a civil war. He says the southern region of that country was churning out masses of refugees. Unfortunately, he says, the number of refugees in what is now South Sudan is three times higher since it became independent in 2011.
I'm just linking these evolutions to my personal experience, and they don't bring a good message. They don't show a good message. Wars have multiplied, and the sanctity of refugee asylum, this pressure has obviously increased as a result of this large swelling of displaced people.
Grandi notes the issue of refugees has always been extremely political and politicized by different segments of society. But he says the politicization and disparagement of refugees has reached unprecedented levels of intensity. He points to the chaotic refugee situation in Europe, where more than 1 million refugees, most from Syria, are living in desperate circumstances because Europe lacks a coherent, coordinated policy to respond to their needs. He warns the rest of the world is looking at how Europe treats asylum seekers.
Now, if Europe starts setting limits, pushing back, erecting barriers, being hostile, the rest of the world will follow, I can tell you. And the rest of the world has a bigger burden. You know, there's only less 10% of the refugees are in Europe.
For example, he notes Lebanon, which has a population of 4 million, is hosting about 1.5 million refugees, most of them Syrians. He says the world must do more to help Lebanon and other countries of refuge. In an effort to do this, the UNHCR plans to hold a ministerial resettlement conference at the end of March that will focus on the Syrian refugee crisis. Grandi says states will be asked to come with concrete pledges of resettlement plans. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
German Justice Minister Heiko Maas says if there are asylum seekers among the people responsible for a spate of thefts and sexual assaults in Cologne, they could be kicked out of the country. Maas said that German law allows for asylum seekers to be deported if they are sentenced to a year or more in prison, which is possible with sexual offenses. German officials have cautioned that very little information is available about the perpetrators of the attacks over New Year's weekend. Officials said yesterday that the attacks were likely part of a coordinated effort by a criminal gang. Police say about 1,000 men, most of Arab or North African origin, had gathered near Cologne's main train station around midnight, throwing fireworks. Meanwhile, the European Union says Turkey is not doing enough to halt the flow of migrants as countries in Northern Europe tighten border controls in an effort to manage the arrivals. European Commission Vice President Frans Timmermans said today that arrivals into Europe from Turkey have remained relatively high, so there is still a lot of work to do there. Turkey agreed in November to do more to stem the flow of migrants into Greece in exchange for billions of euros in refugee aid money, an easing of visa restrictions, and the fast tracking of its EU membership process. A top German Interior Ministry official said yesterday that some 3,200 people are arriving in Germany each day and that numbers have not declined.
One of the biggest donors to the Democratic Republic of Congo is questioning how the DRC government is spending money. In a letter to a Congolese newspaper, the British ambassador to the DRC notes that in 2014, the last year for which there are figures, the government spent almost as much on parliament as it did on the country's entire health sector. Nick Long reports from Goma in eastern DRC.
British Ambassador Graham Zebedee's letter was published Tuesday in a Kinshasa newspaper. In it, he says it's an uncomfortable fact the basic services provided to the Congolese people are mainly funded by the Congolese people themselves, the diaspora, churches, non-governmental organisations and foreign governments. Official figures on how the DRC government's 2014 budget was spent suggest that funding services is not its top priority. Quoting the letter, the ambassador's deputy, John Lamb, repeated some of those figures.
In 2014, the government spent almost as much for the parliament as for the health sector in the country. And 12% of the financial spending by the government went either to the presidency, to the prime minister's office, or to the parliament, which is as much as went to primary, secondary, and technical education combined. Few other countries in the world are so dependent on outside assistance to meet the basic needs of their people.
No one likes this situation, the letter continues, not the Congolese people and government, nor countries like the United Kingdom, who spend $550 million a year to build the Congolese state.
We're proud to be the second largest development partner of the DRC after the United States, and we fully align our spending with the strategies and priorities of the government. We're here for the long term, but no country can spend these large sums forever.
The letter says Prime Minister Matata Ponyo knows what is needed to lift the country out of poverty, encourage investment, collect more taxes, and invest the revenue according to the country's priorities. It says the DRC must also ensure better coordination of international aid, pay public servants fully and on time, but ensure they do not use their positions for their own benefit. If state assets have to be sold, the letter says, do so for the benefit of the nation, not individuals. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
The goal of eradicating polio worldwide is within sight, but public health officials must make sure that vaccines administered after that point cannot cause a recurrence of the disease. Researchers in Britain have come up with a safe strain that would prevent polio reinfection. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Polio vaccines are stockpiled for use into the foreseeable future to prevent another epidemic of paralytic polio once the disease is officially eradicated. Experts say there is always a chance the live weakened virus used to make the warehouse drugs risking new cases of polio. There have also been instances in which mutated viral strains survive in the gut of immune-compromised people after they've been vaccinated. At the urging of the World Health Organization, British researchers have developed safe seed strains from which to make polio vaccine. They modified viral RNA to make the resulting strains genetically stable. The strains that are now used have in rare cases mutated into dangerous forms. Vaccines made from the new seed strains would not pose a health hazard at manufacturing facilities, nor be dangerous if they entered into the environment, according to British National Institute for Biological Standards and Control Virology Division head Philip Miner. He helped develop the new strains for polio vaccine, which researchers describe in the journal PLOS Pathogens.
In the very end game period, more inactivated polio vaccine will be used because that's what you need to do to make sure that you haven't missed anything, if you like. And certainly WHO are very keen on getting more and more manufacturers to make this stuff. So if you do that and you use a very much safer strain, I think you're a bit more secure than if you go with what we have at the moment.
Vaccine is now made from live weakened virus. Miner says the new vaccines would be as effective but safer than current vaccine.
And after polio is declared eradicated, I think inactivated polio vaccine will continue to be used for some time because of the possibility that you're wrong, you may have missed some, you've got chronically excreting immunodeficient people out there somewhere or other. I think there will be a need to carry on vaccinating for polio until you're really sure that you know what's happened, I think.
An expert WHO panel will make the final determination which new strains of inactivated polio virus are safe to put into new vaccines in the post-polio era. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on The Voice of America. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Malaria kills thousands of people each year. But there are some simple things you can do to protect your family. If you can, put screens in your windows. A simple screen can keep disease-carrying mosquitoes out of your home. If you go outside, wear light-colored clothing and long pants and long sleeves, especially when it is dark and mosquitoes are most active. After it rains, empty all containers of standing water. The water in just one discarded tire can become a breeding ground for thousands of mosquitoes. Make sure your home is clear of debris and anything that holds water, including discarded cans, water containers, and rubbish. Empty containers that livestock drink from regularly so that mosquitoes cannot breed there.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one I judge. This one I judge.
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. More than 65 people died today as a truck exploded at a police training camp in the Libyan port city of Zlitin. And researchers say an experimental transfusion of blood plasma from Ebola survivors has been proven ineffective. Coming up, we'll have music from Ghana, and in our feature segment, the fourth part of our series on the sexual exploitation of children on the African continent. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday, Kim.
Well, I have a question for you. Where's the African football spotlight shining this evening?
I think I might know the answer to that question, Kim. The African football spotlight is shining this evening on Abuja, Nigeria's political capital. That's where the Confederation of African Football, CAF, is holding its annual awards ceremony to honor achievement on the pitch in 2015. The big prize to be handed out is the African Footballer of the Year Award. Manchester City man Yaya Toure is bidding for his record-extending fifth consecutive trophy. Cameroon's Samuel Eto'o also won four African Footballer of the Year Awards, but Samuel didn't do it in consecutive years like the rugged Ivorian Toure. The two other finalists for the award are Andre Ayew of Ghana and Swansea City and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang of Gabon and Borussia Dortmund. Among the 10 other awards to be presented in Abuja are Women's Player of the Year, National Team of the Year, Club of the Year, and Most Promising Talent. And speaking of promising talents, the latest Sunny Side of Sports blog post is on undefeated Ghanaian prize fighter Richard Comey, who could fight for a world title this year. You can read it at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. Once again, that address, blogs.voanews.com/sunny. The International Boxing Federation says the 28-year-old Comey will fight in a final elimination bout for its world title in 2016. Comey is a power puncher who fights in the lightweight division. He's won all 23 of his pro bouts. World football's governing body, FIFA, will hold an extraordinary congress on February 26th in Zurich, Switzerland. The Congress will elect a successor to Sepp Blatter, who will step down as FIFA president after a turbulent 2015 marked by corruption and criminal investigations. For an update on the election, we're joined once again this evening by our football guru, David Legg.
Sonny, we've got five contenders, and that looks like where it's going to stay. I don't see Michel Platini at this stage coming back into the race. I know there's talk of an appeal. You lose track at times of whether it's an appeal of the appeal of the appeal. And also Moussa Baliti. Now, this is the Liberian. He went to the CAS, which is the International Sports High Court, so to speak, and they backed the FIFA decision, so he's out of the running. So officially, Sonny, we've got five contenders, and they are from Africa. We've got Tokyo Sekwale, an apartheid-era political prisoner, come business tycoon. He's 62 years of age. Interestingly, he's never held a formal position with the South African Football Association, and I've got no doubt that perhaps some of his rivals, as we get up close to D-Day, may use that against them. The most interesting thing, Sonny, about Sekwale's manifesto is that he favours sponsorship being allowed on national team jerseys. Now, this is quite divisive. Rich national football associations, and here I'm thinking particularly of Europe, they're dead against this. They say that the national team jersey is sacrosanct and it mustn't be touched. It must remain clean, as they put it. On the other hand, Sonny, if you think about it, for most African national football associations, the word cash-strapped applies very much so. And the chance to make potentially a lot of money from having a sponsor on your shirt is certainly worth considering. And Sekwale has emphasized this. He says he's not imposing this on anybody, but he believes that this is an issue for debate, and it's certainly an interesting one. But despite that, the fact is that Sekwale is undoubtedly an outsider in this five-man race. You've got two Europeans up against them and two Asians. Let's look at the Europeans first. You've got Jerome Champagne. He's a former FIFA official. He was quite close to Sepp Blatter, the now disgraced FIFA president in limbo. Blatter himself insisting he's still running the show, but I think we know better than that, Sonny. And the other European is Gianni Infantino. Now, he's the man we all know well from the UEFA Champions League and UEFA Europa League draws. He handles these very complex situations with amazing skill. From Asia, you've got Prince Ali. He, of course, was a contender against Sepp Blatter in the last elections. Prince Ali lost. He withdrew after the first round, but he got quite a few votes. And in the eyes of some people, he's the favourite. And in the eyes of other people, specifically some bookmakers, the favourite is another Asian candidate. He's a Bahraini, Sheikh Al Khalifa. He is the man who at the moment heads Asian football. You could call him the Issa Hayatou of Asia. It's very difficult to call, Sonny, at the moment. I'm going to hedge my bets, but I certainly think Sekwale is an outsider, not because of any particular deficiencies on his behalf, but the fact that he's up against some very strong candidates. And I think some of those other candidates have got extremely big war chests. And as we get closer to D-Day, which is February the 26th in Zurich, it's the ability, I think, to get around from one continent to another, preferably in your private jet, and press the flesh could be a key factor.
David, it's been a while since we had one of your patented African football quiz questions. Can you give us one to kick off 2016?
Yeah, certainly, Sonny. I've had a lot of emails, and everybody's asking the same question. When is the next quiz? Well, the next quiz is now. And the question is, which club has qualified the most times to compete in the CAF Champions League? And that includes the former name of the competition. It was then known as the African Cup of Champions Clubs. So what we're talking about, Sonny, is way back to 1964 when this competition started. So it's between 1964 and 2015. Which club has qualified the most times to compete in the CAF Champions League?
2016 is a leap year, David, so we're going to set a deadline of Monday, February 29th, to get your entries in. David and I will now tell you where you can send your entries.
VOA! It's david.leg, and leg is spelled L-E-G-G-E, at AFP, that's Agence France-Presse.com. So I'll just repeat that one more time. It's david.leg, L-E-G-G-E, at AFP.com.
The Sunny Side of Sports welcomes your comments. You can send me email at sunny@voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237. So remember, February 29th is the deadline for submitting your entries for David Legg's African Football Quiz. The first three people with correct answers will be receiving some of those delightful VOA goodies. Well, the threat of lightning caused first-round action to end early Thursday at the South African Open Golf Tournament in Johannesburg. Reporter Mark Tompkins says there's been a strong showing so far by South African golfers.
Well, the threat of bad weather brought an early end to day one here in South Africa, with just a handful of players left out on course. And there's very much a home feel to the top of the leaderboard, with four South Africans currently at the top. Jaco van Sail leads the way after a round of 65 this morning.
Yeah, I mean, I got off to a really nice start. The first eight holes was just absolutely perfect out there this morning. So, you know, you really needed to capitalise out there. You know, after the eight holes, it really got tricky out there. I mean, the breeze came up and it was really hot. So, you know, I just kept it together nicely.
And he's one shot clear of Sean Norris, who shot a 66. 67s for Keith Horn and JB Kruger this afternoon. And the nearest foreigner to get close to them is a further shot back, Tano Goya, the Argentinian, heading up a group of players who shot 68. One of those players on minus four still out on course is David Drysdale. He'll need to complete his first round tomorrow after bad weather brought that premature end. He just eagled the 15th when the hooter came, so he'll be disappointed to have had to come off course. But it's Jaco van Sail that leads the way on day one. He's shot a round of 65 and has a one-shot lead over Sean Norris.
Thanks, Mark. Mark Tompkins reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Hello, Africa. Dr. Larry Zamoja here, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 88.9 Brila FM. Keep getting sporty sunshine with Sunny Young. We all do at Sports Radio 88.9 Brila FM, broadcasting out of the cities of Lagos, Abuja, Kaduna, and Onitsha in Nigeria, as well as the World Wide Web on www.brilafm.net. I tell you this. It's always a thrill, yes, a thrill, to remain on the sunny side on Brilla with Sunny. Keep listening, Africa.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Finally, here's a sunny side of sports salute to Ken Griffey Jr. and Mike Piazza, who on Wednesday were officially elected to Major League Baseball's Hall of Fame. They're the only two members of the class of 2016. Ken Griffey Jr., one of the greatest players of his generation, enters the hall in record fashion. He was named on 437 of the 440 ballots returned by members of the Baseball Writers Association of America. That's a record 99.3% of the vote. Ken Griffey Jr., he was a slugger, 660 career home runs. That's sixth all time. Piazza also could hit the long ball. 427 home runs, the most ever by a catcher. Congratulations, Ken Griffey Jr. and Mike Piazza. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the fourth part of our series on the sexual exploitation of children in Africa. And next, Zimbabweans seem to be worse off today than in 2009. But first, some music. Here is Joel of Ghana with One Man Down.
Cruise me around in your car, but thank God I got my own home. And I thank you for that, I thank you for that. So why you the envy? Used to pay my bills before, but now I they pay for two. And I thank you for that, I thank you for that. Brother man, still the envy. Unya yanka, that they be allowed in it is a penny ball. But man no be God, man no be God. Stop all the hating. Lie, lie. why. Man just be man, so you never know why. My destiny changing, I'm living so high. Make you no envy my sign, because where they bless me. Gunshots.
One man down, on to the next one. Oh yeah, no gaba. Another man down, oh yeah, no turning back. Gunshots. One man down, oh yeah, no gaba. Another man down, oh yeah, no turning back.
The DJs, they playing my song. The fellas be loving, they hailing my song. The ladies, they dancing, they using my song for their ringtone. You never thought about that. No man's there on top forever. Whether you short or you tall, rich or you poor, time keep changing for better. And you can't do nothing about it. Another man rain or fight. Because you know be God. And you never saw be past God. Kadawani, no one on yabala man. It does it when it feels just right. It don't you say it's never my type. So make you know they look down on another brother man. Let go. Gunshots.
One man down. To the next one, oh yeah, no gaba. Another man down, oh yeah, no turning back. Gunshots, one man down, oh yeah, no gaba.
Said I would shrivel, said I'd be dead if I ever tried to whistle. But hey, who said it was simple? The feds take your bread so you wouldn't make a nickel. You mean I couldn't pick a pickle? Pick words when I could've picked a pistol. A sick verse, the NSL's got him sickle. Blowing all up in your face like a pimple. Now he said, she said he ain't hit. And if he ain't hit, that's cause he ain't rich. And if he ain't rich, check who he came with. I don't play with this, he said, she say, shh. Get off my
one man crown, another man frown. Why? Because him wants you down. They say one man crown, and another man frown. Why? Because him wants you down. But guess what? Gunshots.
One man down, on to the next one. Oh yeah, no gaba.
Hey, another man down. Oh yeah, no turning back.
Gunshots.
One man down.
Joel of Ghana with One Man Down.
Well, according to the UN International Labour Organization, human trafficking affects over 5 million people worldwide. It estimates 80% of them are sexually exploited or enslaved, and that one out of five of those victims are under 18. In the fourth part of our series on the sexual exploitation of children on the African continent, VOA's Adam Phillips looks at the root causes of these crimes and the suffering they cause.
Karen Staus is program director for Free the Slaves, a Washington, D.C.-based NGO that fights trafficking and slavery in six nations, including Ghana and the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC. She says that in these and other impoverished nations, what begins as a search for subsistence work by children often leads to labor trafficking and ultimately sexual exploitation and slavery.
What happens often is that the parents may feel that they can't afford to put their children in school, and so they take a risk. They accept their children's desires to go off and work in a mining site or work in the nearby bigger town because the children themselves, just like any teenagers anywhere, they want to experience something besides grinding poverty, and so they're looking for something that's more exciting, that looks like they might be able to earn money. And so the parents may be tempted to say, well, if the child works, then we will also have more income for the family. But once the children get into those situations where there's some separation from the family and they become vulnerable to sexual exploitation by others in those environments.
In Ghana and the DRC, many young people are sent by their families to go work in independent and unregulated mines, but are quickly forced to sexually service the men there.
We also have countries where conflict exists and there are uncontrolled armed groups, including, unfortunately, sometimes even national armies. Those groups are kidnapping girls and women and boys and sexually abusing them alongside forcing them to do other types of work.
Sex trafficking occurs everywhere in the world, but in Africa, it can easily become a factor in child marriage, a widespread traditional practice which girls, even very young girls, can sometimes be forced to undergo. In Tanzania, for example, girls from one part of the country may be transported against their will to a tribe in another corner of the country and forced to marry older men. This is technically illegal, according to Justa Maituka of Koede, a grassroots children's rights development and advocacy group based in Dar es Salaam. But compulsory child marriage is frequently tolerated or condoned by parents, tribal leaders, and elders.
Children are forced to marry. Immediately when they are into marriage, they are forced to sex. They become pregnant very early at the age of 13, 14, and very difficult for them to go into labor. Oftentimes, there is even a loss of life, as well as poverty. Psychologically, they are being traumatized, and nobody attends them. Villages are scattered, no opportunity for them to continue with the schooling, and there is no any other alternatives. So the life is completely ruined.
Frequent divorce is another catastrophe faced by many of these enslaved girls, especially in conflict areas and refugee camps where men want sex but also wish to observe the customs of traditional marriage. In such cases, a girl may be forced to marry one man who has sex with her, only to hand her off to another man for marriage and sex and subsequent divorce and remarriage. In cases where a husband takes money from another man for the right to marry and have sex with a girl, he is effectively prostituting her. But Karen Staus says that even if a girl escapes, she may have a stigma to endure.
Where the stigma really attaches is once someone comes out of a situation like that, then they're completely rejected by their family and by their community. They're not able to get back to a place of safe freedom. And so they can be re-exploited in some other way, trafficked again for labor or sex or some other type of exploitive situation.
Free the Slaves and other anti-trafficking organizations are fighting sexual exploitation and trafficking on several fronts. One helpful strategy has been to try to create what Karen Staus calls a positive culture of child protection.
And those programs target both the children who are vulnerable to abuse, the parents and community members who should be protecting them, and sometimes even the abusers who, because of a lack of information or because of harmful social norms around children's rights, are committing the abuse but have the potential to change. And we have definitely seen cases where some of those abusers change.
Education, especially for girls, is also considered key, as are workshops that inform young people of their human rights and the protections they're guaranteed by international law and the African Charter on the Rights and Welfare of the Child. Anti-trafficking activists also want better access to justice. At a minimum, this means compensation for child trafficking victims and criminal prosecution for their exploiters. Access to justice is a subject we will examine later in the series. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Economists predict that prices will continue to fall in Zimbabwe, which might not be the good news for the citizens. Most Zimbabweans seem to be worse off today than in 2009, when Zimbabwe abandoned its worthless currency and started with the U.S. dollar and other foreign currencies. Sebastian Amonfu looks at the journey from hyperinflation to deflation. Economists say this will worsen in 2016 and further affect the economy, as falling prices mean less tax revenue for a government that is struggling to pay its workers' salaries.
Most Zimbabweans seem to be worse off today than in 2009, when the Southern African nation abandoned its worthless currency and started using multiple currencies, chief being the US dollar. After years of staggering inflation, prices stabilize and things have changed course. There is now deflation in Zimbabwe. But John Robertson, an independent economist in Harare, explains that is not the good news it sounds like to either Zimbabweans and President Robert Mugabe's government.
Deflation is normally associated with people having money to spend but choosing not to buy the things they want because they will be cheaper next month or cheaper in 2 or 3 months' time. What's been shrinking in Zimbabwe is the buying power. Government's incomes are only payable out of tax revenues, and the tax revenues are going down. So government is out of step with the developments in the market.
Robertson says given the revenue and economic situation, the government should be shrinking its activities. Since it has not, he says that explains why President Mugabe's government cannot pay salaries for its workers in December. Revenue is falling, but the number of workers is growing. Government workers' salaries chew more than 85% of revenue generated. Gift Mungano is a senior economics lecturer at the University of Zimbabwe and a government consultant. He sums up Zimbabwe's journey from hyperinflation to deflation, both economic situations that have caused pain to most Zimbabweans. Part of the problem is the weak South African rand and Zambian kwacha, which has cut prices for the large amount of goods Zimbabwe buys from those two countries.
That's a major force causing deflation. But there's also another one which is going to remain with us permanently for medium to long-term future. Constrained demand, reduced demand has become a cancer in the bone marrow in Zimbabwe. Low incomes has become the second enemy under the US dollar. So people are not spending. So companies are desperate.
So in Zimbabwe, there were no goods to buy in 2009. Now there's no money to buy the available goods at the close of 2015. Both Mugano and Robertson said there's need to create investments to create a broader revenue base and employment in Zimbabwe to address the issue of deflation. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States, on December 19th, expressed disappointment in the process followed by the government of Rwanda to call a referendum on short notice to amend the Rwandan constitution. Among the amendments considered were those introducing exceptions to presidential term limits. In a statement released December 19th, National Security Council spokesperson Ned Price said, "While we commend the people of Rwanda for peacefully exercising their civic rights, we regret that the arrangements for the referendum failed to provide sufficient time and opportunity for political debate on the merits of the proposed provisions." The United States continues to be concerned by long-standing restrictions on peaceful assembly, association, and free expression in Rwanda. The U.S. urges the government of Rwanda to enable the full and unfettered exercise of these fundamental freedoms as the country moves toward local elections in 2016, presidential elections in 2017, and parliamentary elections in 2018. The peaceful transfer of power from one leader to another is the hallmark of stable, prosperous democracies. President Kagame, who in many ways has strengthened and developed Rwanda, now has an historic opportunity to enshrine his legacy by honoring his commitments to respect the term limits set when he entered office. By doing so, President Kagame would help to more firmly establish a credible foundation for long-term democracy in Rwanda, reinforce the substantial progress that has been achieved towards sustained peace and prosperity for all Rwandans, and set a laudable example not only for Rwanda, but for the region and the world. As U.S. President Obama has stated, great leaders throughout history forged a lasting legacy not only because of what they did in office, but because they were willing to leave office and transfer power peacefully. The United States remains committed to supporting the people of Rwanda in their effort to ensure a strong, stable, democratic, and prosperous future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.